Our reading is from Sarah Stewart. It's called The Story of Whiteness. Whiteness has been used throughout the histories of America and Europe to praise desirable groups of people and exclude undesirable groups. But whiteness is not an ethnic group, a cultural group, or a nationality. In the United States, the Supreme Court legally defined what it meant to be white in a pair of decisions in 1922. In other words, whiteness was created by law to let some people in and keep others out. Soon after becoming a nation, the United States passed a law that only free white immigrants could become citizens. In 1868, the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution expanded citizenship to anyone born in the United States, including African Americans. But immigrants seeking naturalized citizenship still had to prove they were white. And the courts soon found themselves in the position of having to decide who was white. In 1909, the U.S. Court of Appeals in Massachusetts ruled that Armenians, classified as Asiatic Turks, were legally white. This led to the conclusion that other Asiatic races, such as Filipinos, Japanese, and Syrians, might also be white. In 1922, a Japanese man named Taiko Ozawa petitioned for naturalized citizenship. He had spent his adult life in the U.S. In 1920, people who were not citizens could not own land, but Ozawa wanted to become a citizen and own property. Ozawa wrote his brief and made two arguments. The first, that his skin was just as pale as the skin of white people. If pale Armenian Asiatics could be white, he argued, then he, a Japanese person, could also be white. But his second argument was more profound. Ozawa argued that race shouldn't matter for citizenship. He argued that character and a commitment to the United States should be what mattered. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously against Ozawa, finding that Japanese were not white. They said their decision was scientific, because to be white was to be Caucasian, not Asiatic. Then, in 1923, Bhagat Singh Thind, an Indian immigrant to the U.S., petitioned for citizenship as an Aryan Caucasian. He made the sound scientific argument, as science was understood then, that the Aryan or Caucasian people had originated in North India and that he was therefore both Caucasian and white. But the Supreme Court, again ruling unanimously, denied Thind's petition. This time the court said that race was not something defined by science, but instead something intuited by the common white man. Thind may be Caucasian, the court ruled, but he was not white. These Supreme Court decisions were unanimous. A prominent Unitarian, William Howard Taft, was Chief Justice of the U.S. for both the Ozawa and Thind decisions. We have to own our history of whiteness as part of our Unitarian Universalist heritage. America is once again facing pressure for people to align across racial lines. We do not need to do that. We do not need to do that. Resist other people's categories. Share your own values in conversation, in protest, in petition, in assembly. We are all kin. We do better when we work together. We need all of us, in all of our diversity, to build the world we dream of. At the end of March, the leaders of Unitarian Universalism and the UUA erupted in conflict over a hiring decision. Once again, a white male minister was hired for a leadership position at the UUA. This time, one of the other finalists for the position, a woman of color, came forward to say she had been told that she was fully qualified and prepared for the job, but the final decision would come down to fit. The fit was a white man who was hired. The UUA leadership is 80% white and mostly male. This might be a surprise to many of you. because the truth has been hidden by our election for the last 16 years of men of color to the presidency. However, people of color and their allies have been addressing concerns about UUA hiring practices for many years. This particular situation ignited the frustration that many were feeling about the UUA's incredibly slow progress in becoming an anti-racist, anti-oppression organization, something they had committed to 20 years ago in 1997. In the controversy, Peter Morales, the president, resigned. So did two other white male leaders in the UUA. Three UU leaders of color, including Bill Sinkford, the minister at First UU Portland, are now heading the UUA and seeking ways to move the association and our faith forward into a multicultural future. People are still very upset in the UU community, and new dimensions to the conflict continue to come up. It is messy and painful and difficult as different world views, expectations, and experiences crash into each other. Part of the conflict is that UUs of color and their white allies want to dismantle what they call the white supremacy culture within the UUA and in all of our congregations, so that Unitarian Universalists can become a truly multicultural faith. However, others, mostly white people, are horrified by the words white supremacy culture. These words bring up images of the Ku Klux Klan, and clearly UUs are not the Ku Klux Klan. We are good, caring people who want the end of racism. We do not participate in white supremacy culture, and our name, Unitarian Universalism, should not be used next to such inflammatory language. UUs of color, however, point out that in Unitarian Universalism and other organizations in our country, the Ku Klux Klan is not necessary for white people to retain the most powerful positions. So why is that? Their answer, and the answer of many allies, academics, and others who have carefully explored why our society continues to be racist, is culture. Black Lives UUs have asked all UU congregations to stage white supremacy culture teach-ins to help UUs understand this concept. This sermon is Wolf's first step in that process, and the Racial Justice Coordinating Committee will follow up with more education and conversation in the fall. The basic concept of white supremacy culture is that we, white people, and people of color alike, live within a culture that was created with the goal of white supremacy. That culture has been passed down from one generation to the next for centuries, and we now live in it. This is not our fault. It is not our choice. It is just how it is. And the only way to dismantle that culture is to become conscious of it and to create a new one that supports an anti-racist society, an anti-oppressive culture where all people, no matter who they are, can flourish. This is unbelievably difficult to do. It means learning to see what is invisible to most of us and confront that sometimes our very normal ways of being and talking and seeing the world hurt others, even when we absolutely have no intention of doing so. I am a white, lesbian, highly educated, middle-class, cis woman. And that means I was born a woman and I'm comfortable being one. And I am the mother of four children. One of those children is a child of color. I am white. I grew up in Spokane, Washington, where the population is even whiter than Portland, if that's possible. I knew only a handful of people with brown or black skin growing up. When I was in the second grade in 1972, there was an African-American boy in my class. He was perhaps the only African-American in my school. His name was Rodney, and he was my friend. One day, someone called him a bad word for being black. I did not know any such words and wasn't there when it happened. I didn't know who did it. But I knew it was bad, and that Rodney's feelings had been hurt, and that the grown-ups were very upset. When I saw Rodney afterwards, I felt so awkward. I had no idea what to say to him. I knew he had been hurt, and I wanted to say something kind or helpful, but really didn't know how to address that pain, the pain of being called a bad name for the color of his skin. I had no idea what could help him. I think I just played with him in hopes this awful thing would just go away. There were 3 African Americans in my high school. They stood out, and I felt their difference in some way I couldn't articulate. All of us white kids were normal, and they were different. They just looked different. I knew that. I didn't feel like they were bad different, just different. And I was always acutely aware that they must experience racist acts, like my friend Rodney had. And I hoped it didn't happen, but I didn't know for sure. And I certainly felt too shy and awkward to ever ask them. My college and graduate school were similarly white. I remember being in Chicago and Seattle as a young adult and being amazed that places in the United States had so many people of color. I rarely thought about people of color in my country or the bigger context of their lives. For me, racism was when an individual was mean to another individual, like someone had been mean to my friend Rodney. The near invisibility of race as an issue in my life, and that means it took me a very long time to even notice that we have a significant problem in our country. Many brown and dark-skinned people live without economic resources and opportunity and access to education. They are controlled by an ongoing threat of violence. The invisibility of race in my life meant that I have been blind to the ways powerful white people in the U.S. history have systematically used, hurt, and destroyed people of color for their benefit, or the ways white people in power have created policies and practices that have kept people of color out of power and in positions of low-wage labor that have benefited white people. I did not understand how these actions toward people of color made my own life better, easier, more comfortable, even though I did absolutely nothing to make it happen and found it abhorrent. Talking about race and confronting racial issues makes me so nervous. I know I'm blind. I know I blunder along trying to figure out what is going on and how I can make a difference and that I might hurt or offend a person of color, or that I will sound stupid and ignorant before others who have worked harder and know more about white privilege and white supremacy culture than I do. I usually feel so uncomfortable dealing with race, and I hate feeling uncomfortable. I want to be competent. I want to be seen as somebody who knows things. I want the curriculum to be masterable. I want to be able to master it. I don't want anyone to get mad at me over things I don't even know that I'm doing. I don't want to be the kind of person who hurts people. Sometimes the discomfort means I just want to ignore racial issues and hope it all just gets better by itself or through some other good people's efforts. But I am a white person, and I'm raising a child of color, and I want her life to be open and full of possibility. I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister and want to transform our culture and system so it is possible for all people to flourish. And for that to happen, I have to confront racism in our country, and I have to be able to be uncomfortable. White people often feel we do not have a culture. Everyone else has a culture, but we are bland, normal, just the right way you're supposed to be. And that is because culture is natural and invisible to those who live within it. What we do is normal, and what other people do is their culture. Culture is the behaviors and beliefs of a particular group of people. A culture tells us how to be together, our worldview, how we organize and get things done, and what we think is important, what is considered to be okay to talk about, how we structure our work, and our ideas about time, food, and child raising. What most, but not all people in this room would consider normal, the right way to do things, and what is polite and appropriate, is white culture. How we understand time, for example, is something we learn from our culture. In white culture, beginning and ending on time is very important. White people view time as a commodity, and we keep very close track of it. This is not true in other cultures. In fact, the white culture obsession with beginning and ending on time is considered by people with different cultural norms a way to shut people down and not listen to them. Culture gets into us, and it drives our emotional responses. If I, a white person, was in a meeting where we decided not to attend to time, but to fully listen to everyone before making a decision, I would start getting really anxious. Once we passed what I considered a reasonable amount of meeting time, I probably would get irritable and unable to pay attention. On the other hand, if some people's voices are silenced by timekeeping, they might feel irritable, unheard, and unwelcome. They might be unwilling to return to that group of people. That is conflict. Emotion rises because people's expectations of proper behavior are not met. And it's no one's fault. No one is right. But it can be really difficult and really painful to resolve those kinds of conflicts. Culture also determines the appropriate expression of emotions. In white culture, measures are measured and controlled. The range of acceptable public emotion is very narrow. Intense emotions are considered out of control, hysterical, and/or a sign of a weak person. Such emotions, particularly in public places, can make white people exceedingly uncomfortable, and they are likely to judge people who do this. However, for people from cultures where emotional expressions of anger or sadness or joy or frustration is normal, not expressing them feels like not being heard or being themselves. Again, no one is right or wrong. It's just different, and it makes it really hard to work together. When one culture is dominant, its cultural rules are the rules of the public sphere. All people must follow those cultural norms in order to be successful. White culture is the dominant culture in the United States. That means that those of us who come from white culture get to decide the ways we use time and appropriate emotional expression in places of work, in churches, in schools, in all the places we come together. White people expect adherence to our cultural norms. If others do not obey them, they are criticized and often shut out, losing jobs, PTA volunteer squads, places and churches, and more importantly, access to resources and power. A culture has hundreds of rules, and they are completely unconscious, almost all of them, unconscious to the people who live within the culture. We learn them young, and they are wired into our brains. And white people accept adherence to their rules because it is the right way to do things. We don't even know why we think it's the right way, but it is so ingrained into our psyche that it just is the right way. White culture has some overriding values and rules we can identify. White culture values individualism. People must make it on their own, and it also values winning at all costs. White culture teaches that issues are either or and never both and. That is black and white thinking. People and situations are either good or they're bad. Something must be one way and not another. Either or thinking allows people the ability to act quickly since nuanced decision making is not required. However, it limits creative thinking and inclusion of others in decision making. White culture has a very low tolerance for uncertainty. This creates a need to solve problems quickly. Situations must be resolved, even if it means not taking time to look at all perspectives or building relationships as we make decisions. White culture believes in hard work, action, and task completion. Success is about concrete accomplishments. White culture loves an action plan and a list of tasks to complete to show that we have succeeded and done what we said. And I have to say, I really love the concept of an action plan with a task list. And I have one, and I have never gotten through the task list this entire year. so I never feel particularly successful. White culture teaches that successful people work hard and they are persistent. This allows those immersed in white culture to believe that unsuccessful people did not work hard and they were not persistent. Because clearly, if you worked hard and persistent, you would have succeeded. In white culture, hard work and success are very tightly wound together. White cultural goals are status and materialism. Individual value is determined by what people do and what they have. Successful relationships, happiness, wisdom, kindness are not held up as life's main goals. White culture values status and rank over relationship every time. Those with power and status, we believe, deserve more respect and they deserve more resources. White culture teaches minimal expression of emotions, lack of complaining, and moderation in all things. White people are taught to deny emotions or push them away or ignore them. We are taught that emotions show weakness or are embarrassing. White culture came from Europe. No surprise. This culture, with its focus on individualism, status, hard work, material wealth, either-or thinking, denied emotion, created the necessary worldview that allowed European conquest of the Americas, Africa, Australia, and much of the Asian subcontinent. The purpose of the culture in contrast was to accrue wealth, power, and privilege to Europeans. It allowed, without any moral conflict, European people to take the land of brown-skinned people while killing them or subjugating them to European rule. In the rules of European culture, non-Europeans were simply inferior and could be dominated. This was the outgrowth of either-or thinking and success as status and wealth. White culture really is a white supremacy culture because the goal and orientation of that culture for hundreds of years has been increasing the wealth, power, and privilege of white people. The culture insists that only hardworking people with wealth and status are worthy. Increasing wealth, power, and privilege was and is the orientation of life in white culture. In this quest, and by insisting on the inferiority of indigenous people, European Americans killed 90% of the indigenous people in North America and just gave their land away to white settlers. White people then kidnapped indigenous children and put them in boarding schools, removed them from their cultures, and treated them harshly. This further weakened the already very weakened indigenous cultures who could no longer pull together effectively to fight for their rights and their land. White people kidnapped African people to work their land. This unpaid labor gave wealth to white people in both North and South, as the U.S. economy grew on the cotton trade. When white people wrote the U.S. Constitution, they used the document to uphold the enslavement of African Americans as an acceptable act. As the United States continued to grow and develop, it continued the practice of taking the labor and land of brown people. It stole the lands of Mexican people. It implemented laws that legally separated and increased inequality between whites and African Americans. It denied African American access to power through voter suppression laws. As we heard in this morning's reading, it made it so some people could never be citizens and never own property, thus decreasing their possibilities for wealth and power. It removed the American citizens of Japanese descent from their homes and took their lands and businesses and gave them to white people during World War II. It used redlining and limited slots for people of color in institutions of higher education to deny 90% of African-American World War II soldiers access to the GI Bill. It passed strict mandatory sentencing laws for those that have affected primarily men of color. While not exactly legal, the threat of violence has been used to control people of color and keep them in their place for centuries, including now. The tradition concludes to the U.S. to this very day. Right now, white leaders are attempting to suppress votes of people of color. Those with brown skin, Muslim, and Latinas have been labeled dangerous by our president and are threatened with discriminatory policies and threats of violence. People of color are routinely followed in stores, stopped more often by the police for traffic violations and are more often killed by police when they are unarmed and undangerous. The effect of this action has been to increase white wealth, power, and privilege. Those of us who are white liberals might hate the fact, but we have benefited from the destruction, harm, and discrimination toward people of color. We are privileged in this culture, and that has in its very DNA the decision that people with brown skin are inferior. White people in the United States today have more wealth, education, and leadership roles than people of color. White people have been able to acquire more assets over time and more access to education, financial resources, and power. We hear our stories in our history books and see our faces in our leaders in books and on TV. We move in this world as if we belong in it. We believe it is our place and we belong. This result has been intentional by white men of power over the 400 years that Europeans have dominated North America. This result has been made possible by white culture, that it is normal to us as white people as breathing. White culture, without us being conscious of it at all, keeps creating the same results it was designed to create, wealth, power, and privilege for white people. So what is to be done? White people must dismantle white culture, as much as it has benefited most all of the people in this room. Our society needs a culture that values community more than individualism, and values both an and thinking rather than either or thinking. We need the capacity to sit with uncertainty. We must craft cultural goals that are not wealth and status, but perhaps the number and quality of relationships, or the capacity for compassion and giving. The truth is, white culture isn't good for those who call themselves white either. Many white people work very hard and are constantly busy trying to prove that they are successful. This is what our culture says makes us worthy of love and belonging. However, many white people never feel like they do enough and always feel unworthy. And that is not the culture we want us to live in, or our children, or our grandchildren. Dismantling white culture is really hard and difficult work, and it is the work of white people in the quest for racial justice. People of color cannot do it for us. They cannot teach us about it. Giving charitably to people of color and helping them acclimate to white culture will not end racism. That work is not enough. Only challenging our cultural norms and DNA will change racism. To successfully dismantle white supremacy culture, we have to face the ways it has benefited us. We must see how the suffering of people of color has made our lives easier. We must become conscious of our culture and how it affects our behaviors and of ideas of right and wrong, and of what is worthy and unworthy. We must listen to people of color who have different experiences of our culture as they interact with it. They see it from a different dimension. It's helpful for us to know what that is. We need to also learn about their cultures and other human cultures so we can learn about other ways of being human together. There are many ways to be human together that people have created over the centuries, and ours is certainly not the only one. With our own culture, we must decide what to keep and what to discard. Not everything about white culture is oppressive. I love the emphasis on learning what one loves to do and the importance of persistence to improve skills. The work of dismantling white supremacy culture requires white people to be humble, which is not one of our greatest gifts. To admit that we are blind and to commit to seeing, to learning, and to listening. We must learn to be okay when we are extremely uncomfortable. When someone is suddenly expressing loud emotion and we want to crawl into ourselves because people shouldn't do that. We just have to live with the discomfort. And who wants to admit that the sacredness of strict rules of timekeeping might oppress other people? I personally love that. How does one negotiate that when not keeping strict, how does one negotiate that when not keeping strict time rules makes us feel oppressed? But other people feel oppressed if we do that. How do you negotiate that? That is challenging work. And so how does one find the courage to sit in that uncertainty, that whole place where we just aren't going to choose right away which one's right, and seek a both-and solution rather than that simple either-or solution? That is a hard and difficult place to sit, and you have to have faith that it's going to work. And mostly in white culture, we don't. We're like, just pick. It's got to be either-or, one way or the other. The best way, our way. Dismantling white supremacy culture is a really difficult and a very courageous spiritual path. It requires faith. It requires listening deeply to the world. It is a spiritual practice. It requires that we do spiritual practice so we can learn about that space between us and whatever triggered us, that space that doesn't trigger all our cultural norms and our childhood norms. It requires a very, very deep commitment and a supportive, loving community to help people through the painful parts when our feelings have been so hurt by something we had no idea could hurt someone else. And we need a place to celebrate our successes. It's my hope that WOLF can offer white people in our congregation the nourishing place to do this dismantling of racism with the goal that I know we all share of creating beloved community where every single person on this planet can flourish.
If you have any questions, let me know.
Thank you. That was inspiring, motivating, at least for some of us. I know that Reverend Morales resigned at the time of the election, but I don't know, at least from him, why he made that reaction.
I don't know either. I know when the controversy came out and it was public, that this Latino woman had been one of the finalists and had been told that she had the qualifications for the job, that he wrote a letter to the staff, which his staff at the union, which then became public, and in it he really defended the work that the UUA has done to increase people of color, and they have, but it's mostly been at the level of secretaries and janitors, not really in the leadership. There's been a little increase in the leadership, like one person of color in the last 10 years or something. I don't know. It's been pretty minimal, actually. So he defended that. And then at the end of the letter, what he said was something about that, people needed to have a more measured reaction. It's kind of this white culture language, actually, and stop being, like, so hysterical. He actually used the word hysterical, which is actually code word for you're a little out of control, white women, any women and people of color. And so he used that language, which did not go well for him, I have to say. There was a lot of letters from people, there was this one letter from ministers of color in our denomination who are some of the most amazing ministers that I know, and it was a very measured and lovely letter, but it really did call out the using of the word hysteria. And so Peter Morales decided to resign. He said, what he said in his resignation letter was that he just didn't feel like he could take things forward after that. I don't know. You know, he decided it in like one day. So, I mean, I think he's was feeling pretty dumb. So I don't really know, and I don't know if he regrets it or anything.
I just wanted to comment on the concept of discomfort, because discomfort makes us feel terribly uncomfortable and wants it to stop. So the internal question, the internal sentence we usually have in response to feeling uncomfortable is, how do I get out of this? What do I do to stop this? Do I run away? Do I attack? Do I ignore? What's up? Instead of thinking of discomfort in a negative way, think of it in a positive way. It's a sign to yourself that something's different. So the internal question really should be, why am I uncomfortable? Is there anything I can do so that I am no longer uncomfortable? Can I ask this person, why are we having this discomfort? Anything, when you feel discomfort, ask yourself why and what it means. That's the first part of being able to make those kinds of changes.
And a lot of people say that the only way we do change is when we're uncomfortable. You know, we can sort of have lofty thoughts about changing, but it's really when we're in the moment of discomfort that we actually will change things in our behavior and the way we think.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Tracy. I had a question about Bill Sinkford, and I wondered, Bill Sinkford was, of course, the president of the UUA for a number of years, and he was, the second person of color to hold that office in the history of the UUA?
He was the first. Okay.
But I'm wondering, in light of all of this, if that was the token gesture, and that was supposed to be good enough.
I think some people would definitely say that's true. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because the rest of the organization hasn't changed under Peter Morales or Bill Sinkford. And I know Peter Morales has had a really rocky presidency. It's just very complicated. I mean, all these issues are complicated, and what's race and what's other things, but some people think that it's race, but, it's hard.
I'd like to say a couple things. One is I noticed that, like the Indian nations, have actually grown in strength, and there certainly were people who've been well, which has been well pointed out that we pressed and took things away from them, that they're showing. But the other thing that bothers me more is the day-to-day complications. When we call Latino people illegal residents here, illegal.
People can be illegal.
They're not illegal. They're refugees.
Or undocumented or something. Yeah.
They're refugees. Just like most of all of us are, either directly or indirectly, we're a nation of refugees. And why they consider them illegal. And you hear that all the time.
Yeah, it's
we have a pulpit. We need these people at the cash register, at the gas station, working everywhere, laboring, building, and we have an opportunity, that's our pulpit too, to extend that difference.
Thank you, Tracy. I'm struck by our doors from our original church. And I think they are a wonderful reminder about our past, but also that we're moving on. And I hope that we can talk with our people who do the artwork in this room to allow those doors to stay as reminders.
Tracy, can you tell me more about the issue of women and the leadership of the UUA? I have the impression that even more, perhaps, than race, there is the issue of women not being given their place. I know that Morales won against wonderful Laurel Holman,
the first, I think it was the first woman to run for president of the UUA. Happens to be a past minister of mine in Bloomington, Indiana. I get the impression that women run most churches at the congregational level, and yet it is men in charge.
It is at the UUA. It's true. There are there's better representation of women than there is of people of color at the UUA, but it is primarily white male ministers. And so there's a certain people are also pushing back about that. There's other kinds of religious professionals. There's other people who have many great skills who could serve in those roles, but we primarily put white male ministers in those roles.
There are
more women though than people of color.
There will be a woman president of the UUA.
There will be a woman president. We have three of them running.
Just two things I wanted to mention. I know Morales got a lot of pushback when he did resign from people who believed he missed an opportunity to demonstrate apology and transformation within his own role. And secondly, to that issue of discomfort, and I'm not sure how much I believe the basic tenets of this, but I find it a useful framework to think about my own discomfort. There are those who say that there is a certain amount of discomfort in the world at any given time, and that my carrying some of that discomfort can lighten the discomfort load on somebody else for that period of time.
That's interesting.
Okay, more.
Thank you. I want to thank you for saving me my psychiatric bills for the future. I've always been a both-end person and not making decisions quite as rapidly as other people, and I always felt inadequate because of that. I felt like I wasn't quite as smart because I couldn't make those decisions as rapidly as other people could. And just listening to you, I'm realizing I've always needed more information. I've always needed to hear the other side, you know, that kind of thing. And so it fed into my feeling inadequate and the whole self-esteem kind of thing. So as we move towards that, you know, just letting you know, sometimes it makes you feel like you're not quite as capable as the person who makes the quick decision.
And the other,
I wanted to know do you put this sermon online? Is it on tape? I want to read it again.
It is on tape. It is
okay.
On tape. And I will, I meant to do this but didn't have time. I will put together some resources that we can keep at the social justice table that I think are really helpful that you can read just to get more depth. I think reading about white culture, I have had the same reaction as you. I'm like, yeah, I don't really like some of that stuff, but I see how it plays out. Like, it's really interesting to see the agenda of the current administration and how it just aligns perfectly with this white domination scenario that we keep doing. It is clearly still here. Like, it did not go away. And so, and then also how it plays in my own life, just like that. Like, oh, yeah, that hasn't worked real well for me, actually. It doesn't really work really well for lots of people I know. So I think there's an opportunity for, they sometimes say, you know, you're working for someone else's liberation, that you find your own as well. And I think this work actually has that in it. It's not a real healthy culture for anybody and the earth as well. It's just not helpful. So.
Thank you again, Tracy.